Fisheries in the Great Lakes are indeed under stress from a number of problems, invading mussels, climate change are a couple of them, and we'll talk about the health of the Great Lakes next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network, and really pleased to have Titus Sauheimer join us. He's a fisheries specialist with the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute based on the UW-Green Bay Manitowoc campus, and it's great to have him back to be with us again. What changes in the Great Lakes have you noticed? Are you wondering about fish populations, maybe? Love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Titus, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me, Larry. Great to be here.
Well, let's go to the Wisconsin Sea Grant program first. There are people who probably aren't familiar with it, but just what is it and what's it all about?
Yeah, well, Wisconsin Sea Grant is one of 34 different Sea Grant programs. We are a partnership between NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the states. And here in Wisconsin, it is NOAA and UW-Madison that partner up, and we work on coastal issues. So for me, that's the fisheries side of things, and you know, it's our Great Lakes. We have over 1,000 miles of coastline here in Wisconsin. We are truly a coastal state.
We are indeed. And here you are based in Green Bay. So you're pretty close to the action.
Yeah, I can just go out of my office and I can see Lake Michigan, which is it's a great bonus.
I would think so. What do you do in your position?
Well, as a fishery specialist, I mean, I kind of cover all our fisheries issues for Wisconsin Sea Grant. So that could be anything from, you know, kind of the health of Lake Michigan or Lake Superior. What is happening in the food web? What are the invasive species doing? And what does that mean for the fisheries, whether that's recreational charter fishing or our commercial fisheries as well? So I kind of cover a lot of ground, and there's certainly always interesting things happening in our Great Lakes.
So let's take a broad picture here. How are the fish populations doing in the Great Lakes?
Well, that is a very broad,
very broad
question. And, you know, certainly it really depends on what fish species you want to talk about, you know, in general. Also kind of the timeline that we're thinking about, you know, several hundred years ago, our lakes would have been much different than they are now. Our kind of, you know, the fish species that we have would be very different if this was, you know, 1722 instead of 2022. So, you know, in general, you know, we have some very, you know, well kind of studied fish population. So we really have a good picture of what's happening with species like trout and salmon that are, you know, important sport fish, also lake whitefish, which is a commercial fish species, but also more a popular kind of ice fish species in Green Bay now. So, you know, I think in general, we've got some really good sustainable fish populations. We can say that. And, you know, if we go up to Lake Superior, it's, you know, balancing lake trout with lake whitefish and the Cisco populations. There's definitely been some declines, but I think we're kind of looking at where we're at and where we're going into the future.
Let's take a call. Gianni in Montello will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, Larry, I'm wondering, I'd like to ask your guest what the deleterious effects of the lamprey eel in our Great Lakes have caused over the decades. And did this invasive species come in through ballast water on foreign vessels?
All right. Thank you for calling.
All right. Well, yeah, sea lamprey, I think it's a great story. I think everybody is kind of, a lot of people have heard of sea lampreys on the Great Lakes. So they are actually native to the North Atlantic. and arrived in the Great Lakes in the early 1800s. And it was not a ballast water transport. It was more of a people started building canals. We started connecting our lakes. Likely the Erie Canal was built. That kind of connected the Hudson River system with the Finger Lakes of Lake Ontario, and that connected those watersheds. Sea lamprey were able to get into the Lake Ontario in the early 1800s. As the Welland Canal was expanded and improved between Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, eventually in the sort of the 20s and the 30s, 1920s, 1930s, sea lamprey were able to get over past Niagara Falls and rapidly kind of spread through Lake Erie and then Huron, Michigan, and Superior. And, you know, really sea lamprey, you know, in their native range out in the ocean, attaching to fish, they are parasitic. So they spend about 18 months swimming around in the Great Lakes, growing. And that's when they're parasitic, and they actually grow very quickly. They attach to fish. They have this kind of rasp-like toothy tongue kind of thing that they rasp a hole through the side of a fish, suck out the blood, the fluids. And, you know, obviously that's not a great situation to be in if you're a fish. Kind of our estimate here, a single kind of adult sea lamprey will kill about 40 pounds of fish. So if we go kind of peak sea lamprey populations in the mid 20th century, there were hundreds of thousands of sea lamprey in Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. And, you know, so massive historical impacts on our fisheries. And that was, you know, they were going after whitefish, they were going after lake trout. Sea lamprey management and control is definitely one of these success stories for invasive species management. So we are pretty much all the Great Lakes now, at least 90% declines in sea lamprey populations. So, you know, the impacts have been lessened. This is a lot of collaborative, cooperative work between the U.S. and Canada, between the states, between the tribes, everybody kind of working together to identify where the lamprey might be and to reduce those populations. And, you know, one of the kind of advantages for us is, you know, for people trying to manage lamprey is they spend a lot of time as juveniles in streams, living in the sediment, filter feeding. And so, you know, that is kind of a good allows the treatment people to get out there. They know where they're at. They can kind of control those larval populations, and that prevents those lamprey from going out into the lake, becoming parasitic. So, you know, basically the take-home message, lamprey numbers are down, but it is something that if we kind of let up on the gas at all, lamprey will rebound pretty quickly. So, something that we need to keep our eye on and keep those levels down.
Yeah, so that just has to be an ongoing year-to-year thing, controlling them.
Yep, basically, you know, yeah, that's, you know, unfortunately, you know, a lot of resources go into that lamprey control program, and, you know, it'd be great if we could use those resources for other projects, you know, restoring habitat, but at least it's a very successful program and keeps those numbers down.
So as we look at the fish populations, is there, let me just put it this way, which fish are in trouble right now?
Well, you know, I'm going to say, you know, if we look at Lake Michigan and you know, Lake Michigan perch populations, you know, I know that, you know, historically there was a really big commercial fishery for perch out in the kind of, you know, Sheboygan South. And that was, you know, an important recreational fishery as well. Those populations declined in the mid 90s, have not returned. And, the commercial fishery closed in the mid-90s. Recreational fishing for perch out in Lake Michigan is definitely a lot lower than it was historically. So that's, you know, one of the challenges. The food web has changed in such a way that probably it's the smaller size perch, you know, they hatch. They have kind of a limited time to find food, and that food just isn't available in numbers the way it used to be. So, you know, quagga mussels changing the food web. To kind of piggyback on your previous topic, you know, phosphorus. We have reduced phosphorus into the lake, which is a good thing. We definitely had too much phosphorus going in back in the, you know, the kind of pre-Clean Water Act. But, you know, now we have kind of this quagga mussels on top of lower phosphorus and, you know, very clear water out in Lake Michigan. But that means there's just not a lot of that green stuff, that algae that is food for the zooplankton, that's food for the little fish. And, you know, so that's definitely a challenge that a lot of people have been kind of following with the perch numbers. Green Bay is kind of a different, it's kind of a counterpoint to the trends we see out in Lake Michigan, where we have kind of lower perch numbers in Lake Michigan, lower whitefish recruitment, so that basically less baby whitefish out in Lake Michigan, and compare that to kind of lower Green Bay, lots of nutrients going in there, and we're seeing a lot more whitefish, a lot more perch, a big walleye population in Green Bay. So, you know, that's kind of some differences there. Even within the same lake, you can see the complexity of, you know, these sort of differences in fish populations.
Talking today with Titus Seilheimer, a fishery specialist with the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Certainly, if you have questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We talked about sea lampreys, got into a bit about perch and quagga mussels, but we have much more to talk about, and we'll get into some more depth. First, we'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us, and Jonathan in Milwaukee and Mike in Slinger, stay with us. We'll be back, and you'll be able to answer your questions or make your comments. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the health of Great Lakes fisheries on the show today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Titus Seilheimer, back with us. He's a fisheries specialist with the Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. He's based at UW Green Bay Manitowoc campus. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about the Great Lakes and its health? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Lots of calls and emails, so let's go to the phones and to Jonathan in Milwaukee first. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for having me. My question is about Line 3 pipeline and Line 5 pipeline and how Enbridge is currently trying to reroute the pipeline of Line 5 that was going to go through the Bad River Ojibwe tribe, and the Bad River Ojibwe tribe is against the pipeline. And there was recently a hearing, and people have about 15, I don't know, they had like 15 days ago, there was a hearing, and people could submit their testimony against it, and about 10,000 people showed up, and 185 wetlands are being threatened by Line 5 that transports 540,000 barrels of crude oil and that goes underneath the Mackinac Straits, which can totally disrupt the Great Lakes Basin, which provides 20% of the Earth's surface fresh water, and a lot of fish live there. So I guess my question is, how are the fish going to be affected if the pipeline of Line 5 spills, which has already done dozens of times?
Well, that's a question you may not have an answer for, Titus, or maybe you do.
Oh, yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. I mean, it's, you know, certainly, you know, thinking about the pipeline kind of running through the, you know, the watershed of Lake Superior, so that, you know, spills within that, you know, fairly, you know, high quality, you know, wetlands, forested areas, you know, that can be a concern. And, you know, certainly the, you know, weak point there with Line 5 is where it goes under the straits, the Mackinac Straits. You know, and I've seen some of the science there looking at modeling, you know, what would happen if there was a spill. And it would, just because of the currents, you know, the straits there connect Lake Michigan, Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. And there's, you know, pretty constant and strong currents that kind of go back and forth between the two lakes. So it would definitely be a, you know, have some impacts. And I know I was up there talking to some commercial fishermen in St. Ignace in Michigan earlier this spring. And, you know, it would definitely impact their livelihood as, you know, fisheries. So, you know, I can't say that I would have a, you know, I don't have a position there. We, you know, things that we do here at Sea Grant, we try to be, you know, non-advocacy, but, you know, it is, there are concerns there. And, you know, I think protecting the water and preventing spills is definitely in the interest of the fisheries.
Yeah, for sure. Jonathan, thanks. Mike in St. Lawrence, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and your guest. My comment is I can remember back in the, must have been the late 50s, early 60s, I used to go down to South Shore Yacht Club. I grew up in Bayview, and I, with my cane pole and a stick bobber and some night crawlers, I caught on my grass, and I'd catch a stringer full of perch, good 8, 10, 12 inches. And I don't even know if there's a limit back then, but I'd carry those 6 or 7 blocks home, and we'd have a fish fry every once in a while when I had good luck. And I remember when they used to do seeing along the beach there, Bayview Beach and Oklahoma Beach, South Shore Beach, and they'd kill me with there'd be northerns in there and bass and all kinds of fish. But anyway, my question is, are they ever going to do anything about the, what is it, the big head carp, I think it is?
Asian carp?
Yeah, in Chicago River. And are they going to finally fix that before they get into the Great Lakes system?
All right, yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think that the big concern there, big head carp and silver carp are those two of that group of four invasive carps that are kind of working their way upstream towards Lake Michigan. We definitely want to keep those out. So currently, you know, some good news here in terms of invasive species, the front of that invasion, kind of where the population is, has been pretty static. It hasn't really moved upstream towards Lake Michigan in about 20 years. You know, so that's a good thing. They're still downstream of that electrical barrier. So there is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers maintains a electrical barrier in the shipping canal. And what that does is if you're a fish swimming upstream towards the lake, you hit that current, you become stunned, and then you would float kind of back away from the lake. And so that has been in place for quite a while. The fish are still downstream of that, so that's also good news. And then kind of the next step that people are looking at is downstream of the electrical barrier is the Brandon Road Lock and Dam, and they're going to upgrade that to kind of put in a lot of different solutions to prevent carp from moving through that lock and dam, through the lock system. They're going to use sound, they're going to use bubbles, they're going to kind of flush out that lock when it's being used so that it's not moving unwanted species like the bighead and silver carp upstream towards the lake. So there's just been tons of research through the years focused on preventing the movement of bighead and silver carp. Their state of Illinois is contracting with commercial fishermen who remove about 2 million pounds of carp out of the Illinois River every year. And so that is, you know, helping to keep the pressure off. You know, when those fish get really crowded, that's when they start moving upstream. And, you know, so at least for now, where we're at, it's pretty good news. They haven't really made it to the Great Lakes yet.
Mike, thanks again for calling. Chuck, and I'm not sure where you're calling from, Chuck. Manieska?
Scott, Minnesota.
Oh,
hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, my question is about smelt in the Great Lakes, and that I believe that's another invasive. And the reason why I'm asking is I can recall when I was a kid back in the 60s, 70s, my brother would go smelt capturing along the North Shore when they were running, and I believe they're running now again to the point where there are people in Duluth that just had a smelt festival. My life partner was out the other weekend taking pictures of that event. And we don't hear that much about them. What is going on with their life history, and what do they impact in terms of native species? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Chuck. Smelt, a lot of people like smelt.
Yeah, you know, smelt, they're small, but you bread them, you deep fry them, they taste pretty good. So, yeah, I mean, smelt are not native to the Great Lakes. They're another kind of North Atlantic species. But they were brought into the Great Lakes. Actually, the state of Michigan brought them into one of their inland lakes as a potential forage source for some predator fish. And I think that was the 20s. They got out, and you know, ever since they've spread out there, you know, throughout the Great Lakes now. So you know, smelt it's kind of a tricky discussion here. You know, there's good and bad with smelt. You know, ecologically, they are an important kind of forage source for a lot of fish species. Lake Superior, Lake Huron, you know, they are major components of predator diets. So there's a positive. On the negative side, they're also predators on larval fish. So, you know, generally, if you have huge smelt populations, that's not a great thing for, you know, lots of small fish, larval fish, you know, trout. Whitefish, you know, the other desirable species we want. You know, check out the Smelt Fest up in Duluth. You know, I wish I had been there. It was on Sunday. they've got some amazing like costumes, and you know, it's a really neat kind of celebration of that, you know, cultural importance of you know, the smelt run. And you know, people, especially Duluth, North Shore, you know, they do have a bit more of a healthy or a larger smelt population up there in Lake Superior. So people can go out in the spring, you know, dip net, fill those 5-gallon buckets with smelt and do a lot of cleaning of small smelt, and then, you know, fry up a lot of them through the year and probably give away a lot as well. Over here on Lake Michigan, it's kind of a different story. You know, we historically had there was a lot of smelt out in Lake Michigan, you know, decades ago. It used to support a commercial fishery. You know, lots of people have memories of going out in the spring, filling up those buckets in Lake Michigan. And it seems like most years we'll have, you know, a weekend or two where somebody in Milwaukee will start catching a few smelt and people get excited, but then, you know, it's like one day and then it's sort of over. So, you know, for us in Lake Michigan, it's, you know, the food web, you know, these smaller fish, smelt, alewives, you know, the kind of forage fish, Cisco or low, but bloater chubs, those smoked chubs people like eating, you know, those are kind of the silvery small fish that, you know, that's what the predators eat. And we still do stock a lot of trout and salmon. We also have kind of that lower food web challenges with quagga mussels and less phosphorus. So, you know, basically, and, you know, kind of to go back to your earlier question, Larry, about, you know, what fish or what species are in trouble. You know, at least in Lake Michigan, it's kind of these small forage fish are kind of in a tough spot right now. And, you know, we see that with chubs, we see that with perch, smelt. So, you know, it's kind of an off balanced food web right now, which means we don't have those opportunities to go out smelting here in Manitowoc or in Milwaukee.
Kevin emailed, he says there are some positives here, despite the changing ecosystem. The diversity and trophy potential of the Green Bay and Lake Michigan sport fishery has been great, world-class opportunities for walleye, muskie, pike, whitefish, trout, and salmon, among others. And he noted already this spring a 30-pound brown trout has been caught in Green Bay, and it takes a Chinook in the mid-30-pound range to win the top Lake Michigan salmon tournaments. I've never caught one quite that big. I did get a 24-pounder, and that was good enough for me to put up on the wall. But comment on that.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. And I think I know which Kevin that is. And yeah, definitely there are positives. And, you know, the size of Chinook salmon in the last couple of years, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, the states had to, you know, kind of reduce their stocking numbers for Chinook salmon. And, you know, that was in response to those low forage numbers, low alewife numbers. But, you know, I think there is that is paying off, and we are seeing some pretty large fish. I mean, Lake Michigan had the world record brown trout, I think, at 43 pounds before it was surpassed by another brown trout somewhere else. But, you know, that is a world class trophy fish. You know, I actually hear some grumbling now about people, you know, I want to catch a lot of Chinook salmon. I don't want to catch a 30-pound Chinook salmon. So, you know, when you're starting to complain that your fish are too big, you know, maybe that's a good problem to have. You know, Green Bay, lots of walleye, lots of whitefish, you know, lots of people coming out in the winter to ice fish for whitefish in Green Bay. Smallmouth bass are, you know, a great fishery in Door County and as well. So, we have some very valuable and important fisheries that are, you know, a great draw for people. People come to Wisconsin to experience the Great Lakes and to experience our fisheries. And you know, I think it's a great thing to have.
Yeah, I was thinking about walleye. The walleye population of our inland lakes has suffered considerably due to climate change, warming water, which has led, you know, to an increase in bass and so forth. So it's nice to know that the walleye population is at least doing well in Green Bay, Lake Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, Green Bay has a phenomenal walleye run. I mean, if you go over the Fox River during the kind of, you know, when the walleye are up in the Fox spawning near De Pere, it's just amazing how many boats are out there. You know, it's just like hundreds of boats out there catching walleye. And you see, you know, people through the summer just trolling for walleye all the time out in Green Bay. So, and that is a fishery that is not supported by stocking. I mean, that is a good, you know, it declined. Now it is a self-sustaining population. And, you know, I think because of the size of our water, you know, Lake Michigan, Green Bay, it's a very big system. And we're not seeing that, you know, immediate warming effect of climate change. You know, not to say that there aren't, you know, kind of longer term, you know, we are going to see some impacts from climate change on our fisheries. And it just might be a bit more of a, I think there's more of a lag there for Lake Michigan compared to an inland Wisconsin lake.
Therese emailed to ask where the nutrients in the Bay of Green Bay come from. The Fox River, she asked. Since the bay is connected to Lake Michigan, none of these nutrients are able to flow that way.
Yeah, so, you know, it's the Fox River, you know, that is, kind of the upper Fox, Lake Winnebago, and the lower Fox. I mean, it's a very agricultural region. It's a big population center. And so there's a lot of nutrients coming in, you know, lower Door County, Kewaunee County a bit. On the kind of west shore, if you look at the Econo, the Peshtigo, there's some agriculture there as well. There's, you know, communities, but there's also more kind of forested area. As you move up the bay towards, you know, towards the end of Door County, if you move to Bay du Nac, it's a lot more like the main part of Lake Michigan, where the water is very clear. And, you know, while we're having, you know, great walleye hatches down here on the lower bay, the Big Bay du Nac, Little Bay du Nac, up there in Michigan, having a little more trouble just because of that, you know, clear water, quagga mussel impacts, you know, changing the food web up there. So, you know, it's an interesting problem to deal with. You know, it's like, you know, we want clear water, but it's also supporting this great fishery. I know some of the work that the new water, the wastewater treatment plant in Green Bay is doing, you know, they get to that, you know, they've kind of ratcheted down their treatment capacity. You know, so now these sort of incremental improvements in water quality would cost a lot of money. And they're actually able to go out and work in the watersheds of some of the lower bay watersheds and, you know, work on the land and try to, you know, take out some of that non-point runoff rather than working in their facility. So I think that's a kind of a good positive there that's happening.
What's going on with what are the efforts to lower the number of quagga mussels or get rid of them in the lake?
Well, yeah, that's a you know, when I told the, you know, sea lamprey has been, that's a successful invasive species management program. Quagga mussels are much harder to deal with just because they're so widespread. You know, there are at kind of small points, like if you have a water intake, there are, you know, chemicals you can use. There's water that you can, you know, kind of spray off the mussels with hot water. There's a product that is actually a soil bacteria that can be used to kind of selectively kill quagga mussels and zebra mussels. Those tools exist. But when we look at, you know, say Lake Michigan as a whole, it's a bigger challenge there. So, you know, I think, you know, aside from, there are certainly genetic techniques that are, you know, people are starting to develop that, you know, gene drives, things like that, you could actually eliminate a population of something like mosquitoes that cause malaria. You know, that is a debate that's happening right now. The technology exists. You know, that is something we could do ethically. Is everyone going to agree to, you know, release something like that into the environment? You know, I think that's a question that we haven't really had to address yet. But a positive kind of note on quagga mussel numbers, it seems like the most recent survey for at least Lake Michigan quagga mussel numbers shows them sort of starting to decline. So I think that is hopefully good news that they're going to decline on their own, get a more manageable population, and maybe see a bit more balanced food web out in Lake Michigan.
And just in 30 seconds or so, what about plastic microparticles in the waters? The Apostle Islands National Lakeshore has a higher amount now. Any information on safety of eating those fish in 30 seconds?
Oh, I mean, that is, you know, the microplastics are definitely a concern. I don't know that we know what the specific impacts are to the fish populations yet, but it is an area of interest of research that we're interested in at Wisconsin Sea Grant and elsewhere. And, you know, I think the fish are safe to eat, but it's definitely something we want to keep an eye on.
Well, Titus, here we are out of time again. I hope you'll come back and be with us once again. It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Larry. Happy to come back anytime.
Titus Salheimer, our guest with the Wisconsin Sea Grants Institute, based at UW Green Bay Manitowoc campus. Great to have him back and get that update on what's going on with fish in Lake Michigan and in our Great Lakes. Tomorrow, Chad Spate back with us to talk about training people for careers in construction and also to take your home improvement questions. You can join us for that from 11 to 12:30, but why not stick around right through the afternoon? Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.